Call to order the meeting of the Commerce Committee. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from February 27th of 2023. Representative Petiza Witkoon, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I have not seen the minutes yet. Sorry for being just a second late.
No worries. We will postpone the minutes until later in the meeting, and we will move directly to House File 1771 by Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman, if you want to step forward. And would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1771, please.
Representative Bierman moves House File 1771 be recommended to be re-referred to Human Services Policy Committee. Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just have a brief introductory remark, and then we'll go right to the testifier. Members, thanks for hearing 1771. This is legislation that would create collaborative care management codes for psychiatry, thus expanding access to psychiatric and mental health care. Mental health conditions are more common than most people think, impacting 1 in 5 adults in our country. We are all aware of the increase in mental health care needed for Minnesotans and Americans. This bill would be a good step in the direction of getting more care and more efficient care to those in need. With that, I'm going to turn it directly over to our testifier, Dr. Michael Trangle, chair of the Minnesota Psychiatric Society Legislative Committee.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Trangle. Before you begin, I'm just going to say on all of our bills today, we are asking testifiers to limit their comments to 2 minutes because we have a lot to go through in today's agenda. So please, 2 minutes. With that, please state your name for the record and proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Michael Trangle. You know, I think everyone here knows that we've had recently exponential growth in the rates of depression and anxiety, as well as substance use disorders. And if you think about it, people that are struggling, almost all of them start out by interacting and making some sort of contact with their primary care doc. They may end up doing that because they can't get in to see a therapist, can't get in to see a psychiatrist, or they're just having some symptom. You know, I'm tired, I'm listless, I don't have much energy. This bill essentially takes the best, most evidence-based treatment for many, many mental health disorders, bases it in the primary care clinic or office, and creates a team that consists of the primary care doc, a care manager, who is sort of like an individual that is trained to educate patients, recognize things, help them measure what's going on with their symptoms, make sure they don't get lost to follow-up, which was way, way common for people that are depressed and don't have their normal initiative and ability to follow up and stay in touch. They get advice from a psychiatrist and who teaches the primary care how to do it, as well as teaches the care manager how to do their things and helps troubleshoot, make sure they continue to stay in their treatment and don't get lost, and if they don't improve, helps modify the treatment plan. This model leverages psychiatric expertise to help primary care docs deal with patients, leverages their expertise so that in an hour or two a week, they're managing 80 to 100 patients instead of the 2 or 3 they might have if they were seeing them themselves. And by improving access and flow through, it really pleases patients. They get help right away. They're not waiting to get in. They get better outcomes. They get outcomes much faster. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, the average patient that's in this thing reaches remission in about 86 days compared to people that are standard care, it's 614 days. Think about how many more patients you can actually help them get better and go down with their lives by getting them through much faster.
Thank you, Dr. Trangle. I have to ask you to conclude
okay.
Remarks.
Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Dr. George Romuto. Come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
I'm Dr. George Romuto, Professor Emeritus, University of Minnesota Psychiatry. Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, committee members. The collaborative care model is an innovative model. I've sent you a document that shows you the efficacy of the model. And I culled the literature to simplify that and summarize it for you. As Dr. Trangle said, there's three people involved in this model. The primary care doc is the leader of the model, and every one of these people operates at the top of their professional license. I have three examples for you to make it real. So somebody gets a heart attack, they go to the hospital, they get their stents, they come back, they're seeing their primary care doc. What happens next? Well, they get depressed. 30% of the people who get heart attacks are depressed. So the primary care doc now not only has to manage hypertension and the medications for the heart attack, but now depression. How well is that primary care doc able to do that? Well, it doesn't matter because he has a consultant at his fingertips. Either he calls or they meet regularly to talk about that. Here's another example. Hennepin County Medical Center uses this model, and the reimbursement is uneven or absent, and that's why we need it in legislation to get these codes legislated. I met with a psychiatrist this morning to discuss this model. Her name is Dr. Helen Wood. She was trained at the University of Minnesota Medical School, and she previously worked as an Assertive Community Treatment Act team member. She is now working within the collaborative care model at Hennepin County Medical Center. She described a series of cases that she needed to consult with the primary care doctor. And I swear to God, and I don't use that lightly, I had no intention of bringing this up this morning, but I spoke to her, and here's where we are. We know there's a shortage of stimulant medication for individuals with ADHD. ADHD is a developmental condition that emerges as focused mental effort is required, and it typically emerges in elementary school. The cases she's discussing with the primary care physician are young adults asking for something to improve their focus. Her assessment often leads her to determine that the patient began using cannabis and is now unable to be productive in school or at work and needs the stimulant medication to improve their attention. The primary care doctors at Hennepin County are choosing to give the patient what they ask for and to prescribe ADHD stimulant medication. What she does is critical. She assesses the patient through the primary care doctor, determines that cannabis is at fault, and supports the primary care doctor in discussing the use of cannabis rather than adding a stimulant medication as the solution.
Doctor, I gave you an extra minute because I didn't want you to think I was cutting you off because you were talking about cannabis, but we are well over time. We are well over time, so I have to ask you to conclude your testimony. I'm sorry.
To complete.
Yeah, perfect.
I'm done.
Thank you. There's no further testimony. We'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I have is there's a new mandate that's being proposed here. When will that be going through the mandate review process as something to be included in insurance coverage?
Representative O'Driscoll, I believe that we determined that this bill does not fall within the scope of the mandate review process, so it is not getting a mandate review. Right, we didn't do that. Yeah. Representative O'Driscoll.
Can you tell us who determined that, please?
Yes, Representative Driscoll, under the statute, it's the chair's prerogative to make that determination. So I made that determination.
Okay, just want to make sure we're on the record that something that does look as an additional mandate in the bill isn't going through the review process. Thank you.
And I will make the record that no one, including anyone from the minority, made any request to me about this bill, despite the fact that it's on the calendar for several days. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Bierman, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to say thank you to my testifiers who I think did a great job of connecting the important issue of mental health treatment with primary care treatment and the efficiencies that we will see with that and the flexibility. And just as far as, you know, making sure that we can get this model in. It's being used in over 20 states right now. It's been proved federally that it is a great model and has some very active support in the state of Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And with that, Representative Veerman renews his motion that House File 1771 be recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1771 is recommended to be referred to the Human Services Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Veerman. We'll move next to House File 770 from Representative Tabke. Representative Tabke, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 770 be referred to the General Register.
Representative Tabke moves House File 770 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And then you have the A3 amendment. Would you like to make your move your amendment?
Yeah, this is just an author's amendment. We've worked together with all parties to get language that everyone is approving of, and so we'd like to add that in the amendment and then discuss.
All right. Representative Tabke moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Tabke, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So this bill is regarding life insurance and someone who completes suicide. And so right now the way Minnesota law works is that if someone completes suicide within 2 years of starting a life insurance policy, the family does not get any benefit from that policy. And after significant amount of research that's happened, the testifiers will explain to us what suicide just doesn't happen that way. And so what happens is it's a short-term period in the vast majority of things. And so what we're doing today is we had talked about pulling this look back period to just 3 months. And after working with life insurance and with everyone involved, we compromised on 1 year. And so that's what the bill does today. As well, we found some other issues with problematic language that's in our statute that we will be working on over the course of next year. So, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of testifiers.
Yes, and before we move to testifiers, I want to say thank you for working to resolve these issues. And I know that the language issues are very important, and we will be taking action on them next year. And so I'm glad that to hear that you'll be working on them over the interim. If I can be helpful, let me know. But I will let everyone within the sound of my voice know that we will be making those changes next year.
Thank you.
Okay, the testifiers. First, we have Sue Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. In 2021, 808 Minnesotans died by suicide, an increase of 107 over the previous year, and projections are that the number of suicides will increase again in 2022. We know that when you combine unbearable pain and hopelessness, people think about suicide. Information that is critical to this bill is the studies that measure the time elapsed between when someone has made a decision to end their life and when they actually attempt to take their own life. 24% said the time elapsed was less than 5 minutes. 24% said between 5 and 19 minutes, 23% said to 20 minutes to an hour, 16% said 2 to 8 hours, and 13% said one or more days. Another study found that 48% said it was within 10 minutes of making their decision. Thus, it's very unlikely that someone would make a decision to end their life and then wait a year or more to make an attempt, which is why it is incongruous to us that someone would take out life insurance policy when they have made a decision to take their life, remembering the time it takes to apply and purchase a policy, and then take their own life to make sure their family receives the benefit. It simply goes against what we know from the research. There was a study that actually calculated how many people might have purchased a life insurance policy while experiencing financial distress, intentionally planning to die by suicide later. They calculated that 0.27% might have intended to do this. If we use that same percentage in Minnesota, that would come to about 2 suicides a year. So it's time to right this wrong and shorten the timelines. Losing a loved one to suicide is heartbreaking and devastating. Not being able to collect their life insurance just adds to the trauma experienced by suicide survivors. I urge you to support this bill today and end this discriminatory practice. And to anyone listening, if you are thinking about suicide, please call or text 988 for help and support. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you in particular for sharing that last piece of information. I appreciate that. Next, we have Seth Snyder. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Seth Snyder. I'm a Minneapolis resident and a Minnesota native. In 2012, my wife Radhika and I were expecting our first child. And we're excited to be starting graduate school, an MD for her and a PhD for me at the U of M. Anticipating how much our lives were about to change, we also decided it would be a good time to get modest life insurance. Nautica experienced postpartum depression that winter with our first child, but she recovered with the help of wonderful therapists and some medication. Now, if we fast forward to the summer of 2019, when Nautica was about to finish her residency as a family physician specializing in maternal health. Since I was working full-time at a local university at that point, and she had signed on to be a family doctor, we thought it'd be a good time to increase our life insurance coverage. Not quite 2 years after we increased that life insurance coverage, our son was born in April of 2021. Everything shortly thereafter fell apart. In the span of two short and very confusing days, Radhika started getting forgetful and second-guessing basic things. She and I chalked it up to new parent exhaustion. After all, she had recovered from postpartum depression once already. She knew the signs and symptoms as a doctor and was specializing in maternal and family health. On the morning of July 4th of 21, I woke up to a quiet house, went downstairs with our 10-week-old baby in my arms to get him a bottle. By the time he finished the bottle, I realized I hadn't seen my wife. When I found her, my baby dozing in my arms, she was already dead. She was gone at 39 years old, just days after a joyful reunion with friends, hours from a family gathering, and she was totally in love with her new family, her job, and our life together. Experts in postpartum mental illness lined up the symptoms that I had seen in Radhika's last 3 days, and they explained to me her death by suicide was almost certainly due to acute, unforeseen, and catastrophic postpartum psychosis. 8 months after she died, I was notified that the life insurance claim was being denied in full. My subsequent appeal was also denied in full, and I was offered only the return of the premiums paid on the last 2 years of our policies, despite being policyholders for 9 years. The investigator explained to me that her death had occurred 16 days before the 2-year mark for the contestability period, and therefore the claim was denied. When I asked the investigator why it was being denied, they explained the clause was related to their need to protect themselves from fraud, implying that my wife had planned her own death as a means to get me and my kids money, but that she had somehow failed to calculate the time frame properly. Mental illness is no more a choice than cancer or a car accident, but two of these three situations wouldn't affect a life insurance policy and a family's financial stability. After Radhika died, I had to rely on the generosity of friends and family and a GoFundMe account to be able to stay in our modest home. Social Security survivor benefits will partly support my family until my kids each turn 18, but we've been cheated out of the financial support that we had purchased and spent 9 years as clients with the company for. People who die by suicide aren't scheming financial windfall for their surviving family members. They're not buying insurance or long-term investments with the intent to defraud wealthy financial services firms. People who die by suicide are victims of severe and legitimate illness, and their surviving family members do not deserve the additional cruelty of financial instability when their lives have already been shattered. Please vote to support HF 770. Thank you for your time and for your service to this state.
Thank you for coming and sharing your story. I'm sure that was not an easy thing to do, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Robin Rowan. Come forward, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. I would like to thank Representative Tabke and Chair Stevenson and Ms. Aberholden for working with us on a compromise that we feel takes into account the correlation between life insurance and suicide. It keeps insurance available and affordable for those who have mental health conditions, and it provides additional coverage for families who are, in fact, impacted by suicide. I also appreciate the willingness to work on the language, arcane language in the existing statute. I like to say that it reads a little bit like a Dickens novel, simply because I want to tell my mom I am using my English degree. but it's not like changing a must to a shall. It's a legal standard, and so we need to make sure we get it right. So I very much appreciate everyone's willingness to work on that in the interim. I will also say that working on this bill has been very heartrending, because I don't think I didn't realize how many families have been impacted by suicide as I was talking to people about this bill. So I was glad we were able to come to an agreement, and I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate your support. And I would also like to commend Representative Tabke for actually reading an actuarial study. Not many people ask for them, and if they do, they usually don't read them. So I am very appreciative. Thank you.
I'm not sure whether to commend Representative Tadke or wonder about where he's at in the world, but I will say thank you for your work on this in achieving a compromise. I know it was a hard bill to work on, and I appreciate it very much. So thank you. We have no further people signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Tapke, thank you for bringing this. It is, and thank you to the testifier. It really, our hearts really go out to you. What an incredible thing to have to live through, and I'm so sorry. I really just raised my hand to let you all know, I just got a very interesting email from the Department of Health, and I just wanted to let you all know the Department of Health has now put up a new website that gives a lot of really interesting data about violent death, and it includes suicide. And I just wanted to note that for members and for the public. You know, often we get a lot of data sent to us, and it, you know, it's kind of easy to look at and go on. But the data there is very, very compelling and detailed and easy to see and really eye-opening. So I just wanted to note that for members to, you know, please take a look. I'm not sure if everyone got the link, but if not, we should distribute it to everyone because it is really quite eye-opening, especially on the issue of suicide. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Tadke, final comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't have anything further to say. I just hope for folks' support and moving this forward.
Wonderful. Representative Tadke renews his motion that House File 770 as amended be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and House File 770 as amended is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Okay. Next, we will move to... I haven't seen her yet. We will move to House File 2257 from Representative Bonner. And while you are coming forward, I will move House File 2257 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Representative Bonner, after you are settled in, you can proceed directly to your bill.
We were expecting to be last, but we will take it. All right. Ready when you are, Mr. Chair.
Please, please, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Well, do we need to move the bill before the committee?
I have already done so.
Oh, sorry. All right. All right. Mr. Chair and members, I am so proud to be here with you today to present House File 57, the Minnesota Age Appropriate Design Code, often referred to as AADC. As many of you know, I have spent over 20 years in the IT industry and the last 10 leading teams in software product development specifically, which is why I'm so excited about this bill today. Minnesota is uniquely positioned as a leader in the nation with an active IT caucus as well as a flourishing public-private partnership, actively working to meet the tech challenges of today in a way that puts people first. Today, most online products are designed with profit in mind, not people, and especially not children. This bill aims to change that by creating a model for all states to follow, leveling the playing field, setting clear rules of the road for businesses to implement changes without creating a patchwork of laws that serve no one. Our grand online experiment called the Internet has failed our youth. Failed to protect their data and privacy, and candidly, failed to protect our kids, period. Here are a few statistics. Roughly half of teenagers aged 13 to 17 report they are worried about spending too much time on their devices. 52% of U.S. teens report having tried to take steps to cut back on their mobile phone, social media, and video game use. 75% of the top social media platforms use AI to recommend children's profiles to strangers, including adults. Often including explicit photos or videos, 90% of girls and 50% of boys say they're frequently or sometimes sent explicit photos or videos while online. 58% of girls and young women report having been harassed or abused online. But there's a silver lining. The AADC represents a vetted regulatory framework that is proven to work. Passed in the UK in 2020, rooted in the principles of data privacy and product safety, we've already seen a wave of change. Instagram now prevents adults from messaging children they don't know, turned off location tracking by default, and introduced prompts to encourage students to take breaks from scrolling. TikTok made accounts under 16 private by default, and stopped notifications to users 16 and under after 9 p.m. At its core, 2257 is simple. It requires businesses to gather only the data required to provide the services requested and prohibits the sale of further use and data. Secondly, it requires online platforms to take an honest look at their products and practices and assesses whether their product presents a risk to children. The bill is proactive, not reactive. Risks need to be mitigated or eliminated before the product is offered to the public. We use this approach every day, from cars to cribs, and it can do wonders for the internet too. It's time to put the interests of children ahead of corporate profits. The bill is reasonable, balanced. Companies in the UK have already found a path to compliance. US children, Minnesota children deserve no less. House File 257 doesn't require content moderation, doesn't infringe on a parent's rights to raise their children. More importantly, it doesn't limit the information, opportunities, or resources available on the internet. Rather, it does ensure youth can access a full spectrum of opportunities the internet has to offer without the harm of predatory data collection and exploitation. And with that, I have with me today my testifier, Nicole Rocha of Five Rights, an international NGO, and the driving force behind the AADC, to testify as well.
Thank you. Ms. Rocha, please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee, and then you can proceed your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Nicole Rocha. I'm the head of U.S. Affairs for Five Rights. As Representative Bonner said, an international NGO dedicated to building the digital world young people deserve. When it comes to the internet, we know that the status quo is not working for our youth. In addition to addiction, we are seeing shockingly high rates of teen depression, harassment, and child sex abuse. This is not an accident. The digital world is 100% engineered and largely privately owned, and the system is designed to optimize engagement for profit. These design decisions result in 95% of the apps marketed to or played by children under five containing advertising, including advertising that is age inappropriate. 60% of school-based apps share kids' data with third parties. And Five Rights' own research shows how accounts registered to children are routinely targeted by direct messaging from unknown adults and with sexual content within hours of being set up. In each of these examples, design choices to maximize profit are driving addiction, harassment, eating disorders, self-harm, child sexual exploitation, and gender-based violence, all for profit. HF2257's approach is based on an international framework that we know produces results and has long been part of our business culture, product safety. If the risk of harm to a child is part of the platform's design, then the solution comes from redesign. The bill requires businesses offering online products to undertake a risk assessment in order to identify foreseeable risks of harm to children arising from their data management practices and mitigate or eliminate that risk before the product is available to children. The bill contains three elements that represent a true paradigm shift in how we look at tech. It defines children as under 18 instead of as under 13, as in federal law, COPPA. It applies to online products likely to be accessed by children rather than those directed at them. We often say at Five Rights that we're not trying to make Sesame Street safer. We are trying to make the places where youth actually hang out online safer. And it requires protections by design and default. It is based on 15 standards that create a thoughtful regime of child privacy by design. We know the model works. Since the AADC came into force in the UK, we have seen a wave of changes to the design of tech products, each of which have improved the lived experience of children and teens. Five Rights thanks the sponsors, this committee, and the state of Minnesota for considering these important design protections for youth online. I'm available to answer any questions about this important measure.
Thank you. We will now move to public testifiers. We have a number who have signed up, the first of which is Ella Collins. I will, as Ms. Collins comes down, I'll just remind people that we are limiting people to 2 minutes today just to make sure that everyone has a chance to be heard. So, Ms. Collins, you can come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed your testimony to the committee.
Hello. Hi, committee members. I'm Ella Collins, and I am quite literally a child of this digital age. I am a sophomore at Carleton College, about 45 minutes down south, and I'm here to share a story with you today that is so similar to many of my peers. I was given my first phone at the age of 13, and I immediately became engrossed in the world of Instagram, social media, Snapchat, and now TikTok. And if I knew now what I knew then, I never would have done it. I was one of those 58% of girls who experienced sexual harassment and sexual assault on various social media apps. At the ripe age of 13, I was in eighth grade, and I was led to believe that my body was worth more than who I am as a person. This led to anxiety, eating disorders, self-harm, and a variety of lasting impacts that have stayed with me till this day, and it is still a battle that I fight with myself every morning to convince myself that who I am as a person is worth more than what I look like on the outside. I'm here today asking for you to support this bill, not just for me, but for my little sisters, Abby and Katie, who are now the exact same age that I was when I first experienced this. I am asking you to support and protect the Minnesota youth. I worked with Live More, Screen Less, a nonprofit organization in the cities this summer, and I heard the stories from the youth. I was engrossed and absolutely included into what Minnesota high schoolers go through every day. I am one of those children of this digital age, and I am here today begging you to support the call for help that we have put out.
Well, thank you for that very powerful testimony. I appreciate you coming today. Our next testifier is Tyler Deers. Mr. Deers, if you come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tyler Deers with TechNet. I just want to say we do have written comments as well. So for the page, could your indulgence supply that to members of the committee. As I mentioned with TechNet, we are in opposition to this legislation. I just wanted to highlight one thing that wasn't mentioned. As was noted, this was based off of a rule that was in the UK through the regulatory system that was over there. Obviously, California had passed it as well. It is currently in litigation right now in California under the NetChoice v. Bonta case. Under First Amendment grounds, I know that there is also some question under preemption under COPPA, which is a federal law as well that was mentioned by the previous testifier. Look, we want to appreciate the openness that we've had with the author on this issue. I know we've met before and want to continue that conversation. But what this would do is it would change the threshold of COPPA's directed to children standard, which is currently law throughout the United States, to the likely be accessed by children standard. What we consider to be an over-inclusive standard that would capture far more websites and platforms and subject them to the bill's requirements. Just for a second, think about what websites would be likely be accessed by children. Now, you may not think of AARP as a website that would likely be accessed by a child. However, the website has several resources for family caregivers, for children, teens, what have you, for grandparents that, you know, resources for grandparents that may be in the family that are suffering from a debilitating illness. So it would capture, you know, websites like that, which I don't think would be the purpose or aim of the bill, but kind of just shows you the broad nature of it. And we think that it would homogenize the internet to all users in the state to benefit what would be defined under the bill as children, which would be under the age of 18. And we feel that that would impact the experience on the internet for adults too, which was originally why the Communications Decency Act was struck down at the federal level for similar reasons, because it was impact the internet experience for adults. Again, we want to continue to work with the sponsor, the author on this, and appreciate the time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Corey Marshall. State your name for your record and proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. My name is Corey Marshall, and I serve as the Director of State and Local Government Relations Central Region for the Chamber of Progress, a tech industry coalition committed to ensuring all Americans benefit from technological leaps. We urge your committee to oppose HF 2257, which would undermine its goals by sacrificing user privacy, jeopardizing many of the safe tools and resources already available to children. This bill would sacrifice all users' privacy in the name of increased security. 2257 would require covered sites to estimate the age of child users with a reasonable level of certainty. One of the only ways to estimate users' ages is with enough certainty is to affirmatively verify it. The de facto age verification requirement would likely result in covered entities extracting even more data about their users. These techniques would have to be used for every user, not just children, resulting in increased data collection for everyone on the internet, even you sitting around this dais. Age verification would be particularly harmful for anyone looking to browse anonymously, journalists, whistleblowers, or anyone looking to participate in online discussions would be forced to disclose personal details so that platforms could apply appropriate settings under this bill. This would limit free expression for groups who need it most. Regardless of the method, age verification would result in more surveillance of users and more data collection in the pursuit of increased security. We agree with the need to build in greater protections for younger users. Some states are already doing that, but some of this bill's requirements would undermine the protections if it tries to create and would end up harming vulnerable users. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I almost cut you off. I apologize. And then we have Jordan Rodell. Forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. I am Jordan Rodell, State Policy Manager at the Computer and Communications Industry Association. CCI is an international not-for-profit trade association representing a broad cross-section of technology and communications firms. While we certainly support the implementation of mechanisms that ensure children's safety online, there are several concerns we would like to raise for the policies House File 2257 would implement. First, the bill lacks narrowly tailored definitions. Due to the nuanced ways in which children under the age of 18 use the internet, it is imperative to appropriately tailor such treatments to respective age groups. We suggest changing the definition of child to a user under the age of 13 to align with the Federal Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, standard. This would also allow for those children over the age of 13 who use the internet much differently than their younger peers to continue to benefit from its resources. Second, when businesses are required to deny access to social media, networking sites, or other resources, this may also unintentionally restrict children's ability to access and connect with like-minded individuals and supportive communities that may not be accessible forums in their physical location. For example, children of racial or other minority groups may not live in an area where they can easily connect with others that represent and relate to their own unique experiences. An online central meeting place where kids can share their experiences and find support can have positive impacts. Lastly, in order to achieve meaningful children's safety protections, it is imperative for businesses to have a roadmap of how to properly comply and avoid unintentional violations. CCIA is concerned that businesses may be forced to collect age verification data, which would paradoxically force companies to collect a higher volume of data on children. Businesses may be forced to collect personal information they do not want to collect and consumers don't want to give, and data collection creates extra privacy and security risks for everyone. We appreciate your consideration of these comments, and I stand ready to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the list of people who signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I have a question for the person from Five Rights.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, great. So you mentioned that this has been implemented in the UK. So we've heard some testimony here.
Representative Kraft, can you talk into the microphone?
Sorry about that. So you mentioned that this was implemented in the UK. We've heard some testimony here about all the challenges that are perceived if we were to do that here. I mean, what happened in the UK?
So in the UK, the internet is still functioning.
Youth are still accessing the internet. What we have seen are a wave of changes from different tech platforms that may seem small on their own, but overall have increased the safety and privacy and honestly user experience for children accessing the internet. So as Representative Bonner mentioned, TikTok has implemented a bedtime for itself. So teens and younger children are not getting notifications, push notifications through the night. Google has made safe search the default search method for children. I know there's more. We just heard of one today. We have to look at, but these kind of small changes that have made the internet more accessible and easier for youth to navigate, and frankly, easier for parents to work with their kids and teach them how to responsibly navigate the internet.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. There was also a comment made about concerns about privacy and gathering information. Do you have any insight on how that was dealt with there, and if there was privacy issues that have come up in the UK when they did this?
Sure. So both how it's been dealt with in the UK, and it's also in the language of the bill itself. So there is always a tension between privacy and safety, right? The safest thing you could do is probably going to be privacy invasive. But the bill does not require identity verification. It does not require age verification. It actually requires age estimation, and that estimation is supposed to be proportionate to the risk presented from the business's data practices. And so an example of that would be, if you are an online platform that is making every user's geolocation visible to other users, that is a risky practice, and you would probably need a higher level of age assurance or age estimation. There are dozens of methods of age estimation, and the bill requires that you use the least invasive method possible based on the risk of harm to your users that is available, and that if you collect any specific information for age assurance, you delete it after it has been, the age has been assured, and you're not allowed to use that information for any other purpose. So the argument that the bill is privacy invasive does not stand.
Representative Kraft.
Good, thank you.
Representative Dotson.
Thank you, fellow chair and Representative Boehner. First of all, I have to say, as a father of a young, grown daughter now, and a grandfather of two young granddaughters, I definitely appreciate and understand the passion behind this. The question I would have is, I see that the Attorney General is going to actually oversee this. Have we looked at what that's going to look like as far as regulation and oversight, and who's going to enforce this once it's applied? Because this is fairly complex, because this just isn't Minnesota. This definitely crosses international lines as well, correct?
Representative Bonner.
I'm actually going to defer to my testifier on this particular piece, because I know that she has a very good answer.
Ms. Rocha.
So the bill limits the enforcement to the Attorney General, and what I would like, there's also a 90-day right to cure, and the 90-day right to cure is based on substantial compliance. And so what that looks like in the bill is, if you are a business that is likely to be accessed by children, which is actually a pretty narrow definition, then you have to do this impact assessment and try and mitigate any risk of harm to children. If you do that, then you get the benefit of a 90-day right to cure. And the bill outlines the objective, but not the methods by which the business is supposed to do it, as a way of encouraging innovation and letting these unique platforms find unique solutions for themselves. But it is limited to the Attorney General, and it is a design bill, so the violations are for the design of the product, and you don't have to wait for the harm to actually happen to a child. Does that answer your question?
Representative Dotson.
Yes and no. I guess the question I would have then is, are there any fiscal notes that may look at what this is going to have for expense to the state of Minnesota?
Representative Dotson, I'll take that one. Just say we've requested a fiscal note on this bill, and of course, if the money was going to come out of this committee's jurisdiction, then we would do that in a separate action. It wouldn't be in today. Today we're looking at the bill on a policy basis, but in the costs here, there's no perceived cost to the Department of Commerce. But if we were to carry this bill in an omnibus and thus carry the cost, we would have a separate hearing where we would talk about the fiscal implications of, in the context of a budget discussion.
Thank you, Representative Stevens. Thank you.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got some concerns about or questions, I don't know, about the data that's being collected here. It was interesting to hear you say that the info or the data collected on making a determination on the person's age would be deleted after that determination was made. What happens if a company is, if there's some question after the fact, if something happens, and that it seems the company would want to keep that information? And I also just have a grave concern about that we might have minors in the state where they're, you know, some online platform has made a decision about their age and has also geocoded their location, and you'd have to do that if this bill is patchworked and only the state of Minnesota is doing this, right? So you have to determine that this person is in the state of Minnesota. So now you've got data that says this is a minor and data that says where this person is. And how do we protect that somebody doesn't hack into that data and now has a target list, especially if they can attach it to things this person may have searched for and looking for a victim? It seems really, really scary to me. How do we know the data has been deleted? How do we, and how does the company protect themselves if there's some question afterwards? You know, if they have to delete the data, how do they protect themselves to, if there's some question about whether they did it properly in a case?
Ms. Roach, do you want to take that? I do know that I think you mentioned just Minnesota, but California has enacted this in the United States, and correct. The UK has as well, and I understand this is moving in, I think, five other states. That might be correct. Four other states, we're number five. But Ms. Rocha, if you want to answer the question.
Sure, I mean, I think those concerns are concerns that are more about the internet at large. I mean, these companies are already collecting data on kids. There has been research that shows that most companies have enough information on all users to predict within like 6 months of their actual age. And so what this bill is going to do is going to set up guardrails. As far as liability, if they need to, again, need to later prove that they actually did the age estimation, we would have to look to what's happening in the UK, and that has not been raised as a legal issue yet. I'm not sure how much of a legal issue that is. The liability is coming from the design choices at this point and not from whether or not they age estimated.
Representative Dowd.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, I don't know, this obviously I think we know the internet is a complicated thing, and I am somebody who actually likes algorithms, because when I sit down at my TV and I turn on YouTube, I want to see videos about cars and airplanes and sailboats. And that's what I see, and I like that. It's efficient use of my time. And so I worry about, you know, are we, number one, from a data perspective, are we collecting data that, frankly, we're forcing companies to collect data that they wouldn't otherwise. And I respect the comment that you made about, yes, companies are already doing that. Some companies are, not all companies are. I think this might require all companies that are participating in this space to collect data on not only someone's age, but also geocoding it to where they are at any given time, which I think is dangerous. And so I worry about the security of that data and whether we're creating a whole new problem. Secondly, whether we're limiting what might be a good thing. Is, you know, these algorithms, I think in most cases, are very good things. And so, you know, and I know I'm talking about both bills that are coming up here all in one. I kind of see them as doing a similar thing. So I really do worry about we're creating this new data and exposing people to potential risk by this data being hacked by somebody, by companies who wouldn't normally keep that data or make decisions about a person based on their age and their geolocation.
Thank you, Representative Dowd, and thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just want to say, you know, so I actually do this for a living. I lead software teams. We do it every day. The beauty about this bill, and I just want to be clear about this, is that this bill is proactive rather than reactive, right? We are addressing the issue before the harm has been done, right? So anytime someone creates a piece of software, an application that goes online, folks interact with it. When you design that particular piece of code, you have in mind things that have to do with regulatory and statutory compliance. You have sort of a set of rules of the road, right, that help you decide how you develop that. The other important part of that is most everybody today uses what's called people-centered design. In other words, you are looking at your user. What does my user want? What do they need? What do we need to get from them? But what's interesting about that, and specifically, that model works great, actually, in this case where we're talking about children. How do we design something with children in mind, understanding that they may interact with this? I would say that companies today are collecting a great deal of data. In fact, far more than most of us actually realize. What this bill is essentially asking us to do is to design your software in a way in which you have a single set of parameters that helps companies to make those design choices and to meet a uniform standard rather than having to do a patchwork, right? So this bill is being looked at as a potential piece of model legislation across the country. And one of the advantages of doing this here in Minnesota is that, as many of you know, we have a very active IT caucus. We have a legislative commission on cybersecurity. We have a technical advisory council, which is a partnership of public and private entities, state agencies, and the legislature, who are actively looking at some of the technical challenges that we have out in the world today and doing it in a people-centered way. So I think we want to make sure that when we're designing things, there's no reason we cannot design a piece of software that can still be entertaining, that can still be useful, that can still give them lots of good data, but we can do it in a way that protects people's privacy. And I think particularly when we talk about children, I think that is something that is long overdue. We shouldn't be waiting till after the harm is done and then trying to intercede. No, we should be thinking about data and privacy on the front of that equation. It's not hard to do. People, and if there's a single set of rules of the road, it actually is a boon to businesses to be able to have that in place, to not have to have a patchwork. And so this is actually better for business. It's better for developing software. And I tell you that as someone who's had to go through the requirements and had to have my coach my team on how to work with a piece of software and how to design it for our customer. So I don't want it to be more complicated than it needs to be. Speaking as someone who's literally on the front lines doing this, we don't want to make life harder for businesses. That's not what this is about. This is saying, businesses, you have all the tools, the technology, and the skills to do this. What we're asking you to do is to put your customer first.
Okay. We're going to go. We have one more person on the list. I want to make sure that we have time to get to the last bill on the agenda. Representative Brindley.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's amazing how often my colleagues talk me out of supporting a bill when they're trying to advocate for it. I came in inclined to support this bill, but frankly, I am concerned that we're getting some doublespeak runaround on this. And I guess, you know, we talk about the advantages of Minnesota, but there are certainly disadvantages to being the first and doing the model legislation, and that is that we don't know how it's playing out. We don't know what the bugs are. We don't know what the problems are. And as much as we are smart and as much as we know IT and as much as we work in this space, we just don't foresee everything. And so that is concerning to me. But I'm also really concerned that Representative Dowd's question about geocoding was really not addressed. And frankly, like I said, I'm inclined to support these bills. I'm a co-author on the other bill. But again, we don't think about all the bugs, and I had not considered this geocoding issue. And so my question is, and I know, frankly, the California law is under litigation. So we can say that, you know, there's other states doing it, but they're under litigation for a reason. My question is, how would this play out? You know, I mean, for example, on my phone, I can disable location services, right? Like on any of my apps, I can go in and disable location services. So would it force a situation then if location services are disabled that you would not have access to certain things, or would they have to have location services because it is geocoded to Minnesota? It is within the state. How does that work, and how does that play out?
The other thing I do want to add, turn over to the question, but also in addition to the fact that there are other states that are considering this and California's enacted it, I just want to note the effective date is of note in this bill. It's not effective until July 1 of 2024. So it's out a ways, to your point. And I think this applies both to the litigation in California and also to the issue that about other states and bugs. The effective date's out quite a bit on this. Ms. Rocha or Representative Bonner, Ms. Rocha?
On the geolocation question, this is not something that's unique to this bill. I mean, many states have data privacy protections, and those apply to residents. So Colorado has a law, Connecticut has a law, Washington, Virginia have comprehensive data privacy schemes, and those apply to residents of the state. And so there are many ways that platforms can tell where an individual is, whether they are in the state, whether they are resident of the state. And this bill specifically only deals with information that is personal information, and so it's something that is identifiable to an individual person. When you're looking at an actual device, you don't necessarily have to identify it to the certain person. So this is already being done in a lot of laws. When it comes to the question of whether or not, so if you turn location off on your phone and how does this bill interact? So the protections in the bill are by default, meaning they can be toggled off, right? Like right now, location is on probably for almost every app that you download onto your phone. You can turn location off. So it's by default, it doesn't have to permanently stay that way. That's one thing. And the bill is also very specific. If you're requesting a service that requires geolocation, like your maps or navigation, then you can use the geolocation for that. You just can't be collecting geolocation information if it's not necessary to provide the service requested.
We're going to have to move at this point on to a vote on the bill, but in order to make sure we have enough time for the other bill. So Representative Bonner, any final, very brief final words?
I just want to, briefly say just to the point that I do want to remind everyone that this is currently being used in the UK. It is actually out there in practice in the wild right now. I want to thank the committee for the questions that they've given today and for the opponents for their work on this important issue. You have before you a measure that's reasonable, it's vetted, it's been proven to work. Companies are already complying with this law in the UK and gearing up for compliance in other parts of the country. I'm committing to working with each of them. But quite frankly, we've waited long enough for tech to self-regulate. And we've waited long enough for Congress to act. Today, we're here to ask you to stop waiting and to step in. This is about putting our children and youth first, not allowing their privacy and well-being to be an afterthought. We can and we must do better. Our kids deserve better. We must put the best interest of our children first. And this bill allows us to create a digital world that provides the protections that our children deserve, rather than the harm that is being suffered by our youngest citizens. I respectfully ask for your vote.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 2257 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 2257 is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Pardon me? Oh, the minutes. Yeah, the minutes would be a good thing to do. Representative Cahiza-Watoon, do you have a motion on the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes from the 27th.
Representative Cahiza-Watoon moves the minutes from February 27th, 2023. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes from February 27th, 2023 are approved. Our last item on our agenda is House File 1503 from Representative Robbins. I will move House File 1503 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And Representative Robbins, you have the DE7 amendment, which is an author's amendment. I will move the DE7 amendment. I assume, Representative Robbins, this is an amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE7 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. DE7 is adopted. Representative Robbins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I know that our time is limited, so I'm going to keep my remarks much more truncated than I wanted to. But I appreciate you hearing this bill. I know we had a fantastic discussion in this committee last year, and I really look forward to this opportunity. So I appreciate you all letting me come back. The bill, for those of you who are new to the committee, I did introduce this bill last year. Basically, what the bill does is it bans social media companies from using algorithms to target unsolicited content at kids under 18 in the state of Minnesota. So it's very narrow, despite what you may hear later from some of the opponents. And I did want to just highlight a few changes from those of you who heard the bill last year. First of all of the amendments that were incorporated in both the House and the Senate are incorporated in the DE. I also tried to accommodate additional changes requested by various groups, adding additional language regarding SMS and video streaming and learning management systems, just to make sure people knew those were not covered by this bill. I also met with every single person who requested a meeting and attempted to incorporate the spirit of all the requested changes that didn't weaken the intent of the bill. Those speaking in opposition to the bill today have never sent me any specific language that might address the concerns they are raising. I have added or tightened some of the definitions in the bill to tailor it to specific issues I'm trying to address and to stop online targeting. That's really the focus of some of these changes in the definition and how targeting works. Finally, I added a requirement that the social media platforms obtain verifiable parental consent prior to a user opening an account. And I just want to say that this request was brought to me by a mom from here in Minnesota. Her name is Shannon Lee, and she's not able to join us today. But she is a mom who lost her beautiful daughter, Ashlyn, to suicide due to online bullying. And she has an incredible story, and she's been an incredible champion for not only this bill but other things to do with cyberbullying. Based on my work with Ms. Lee, I've also introduced a separate bill that would ban anonymous apps that are used on Snapchat for cyberbullying, and I hope that will also get heard this session. But this bill, as I want to revert to, is very narrowly targeted at the one issue of these social media companies shoveling things that our kids have not liked or followed, unsolicited content to them. So with that, I have a lot of I want to say, but I want to give my testimony time to my testifier, so I welcome comments after the testifiers have finished.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. So we do have 10 people who have signed up to testify. If everyone's good about sticking to 2 minutes, that will leave 10 to 15 minutes because we can go over a little bit for discussion. So I'm asking everyone to be very cognizant of the two-minute rule. I'm going to give two names at a time so the second person can come up and be ready to go when the first person is done. So first up, we have Katie Shatusky from Thumbs Up, who will be followed by Mary Hampton. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Hi, thank you for having me today. My name is Katie Shatusky. As mentioned, I work as the executive director of a nonprofit called Thumbs Up. We support mental health and suicide prevention through several different programs, including a teen after school program, teen and community outreach events, and youth-led suicide prevention programs. We opened our doors to our after school program in February of 2022 to fill a gap for teens struggling with mental health. Since our February 1st opening, we have had 985 visits to our center, primarily middle school students. Teens 13 to 18 spend more than 3 hours a day on social media, but some spend up to 9 hours daily. This statistic is alarming, and I'd argue the 3 to 9 hours a day is actually under average. When polling the students at Thumbs Up, several admitted 10 to 14 hours a day on social media. Our youth lack the decision-making skills to monitor their cell phone use. They bring their cell phones to school, using them in class without regard to the teachers. And I constantly hear teachers talking of how out of control the cell phone use is in the classrooms. Social media has also been linked to teen drug use and mental health problems, and our family has experienced this firsthand. My oldest daughter is 17 years old. She was given her first cell phone at the age of 11, which I very much regret, and if I could go back, she would not have a cell phone. She has struggled with her mental health for several years. Many of her struggles stem from her cell phone and social media use. During the pandemic. She was found in her bedroom about 95% of the time scrolling through social media. She's experienced bullying through social media, which has also caused additional mental health concerns. Kids are constantly being encouraged to follow social media influencers. Unfortunately, the highlight reels are not real life. Social media promotes negative experiences, and it's hard, even as an adult, not to feel inadequate about your life and appearance after scrolling. TikTok and other sites have also been linked to anorexia and body issues, and I just want to share a real quick story of something that recently happened to our family. My oldest daughter had three of her friends over. We invited them all to dinner with us. When we got to the restaurant, they all declined to order anything off the menu. We asked several times until, honestly, it was awkward. When we got home, my daughter shared with us that all three of her friends had eating disorders and that continually asking them if they wanted to order dinner was very uncomfortable. I just want to ask, how do you wrap your head around three out of four teens in one friend group having eating disorders? A recent investigation by the Wall Street Journal revealed that Facebook was unaware of mental health risks linked to the use of its Instagram app, but kept those findings secret. Internal research by the social media giant found that Instagram worsened body image issues for one in three teenage girls, and all adolescent users of the app linked it to experiences of anxiety and depression.
As much as I agree with your testimony, I have to ask with you to wrap it up.
So. Okay. We as parents can try to manage and regulate social media use, but it's an uphill battle we can't win, and we're asking for your help and support. Thank you.
Next testifier is Mary Hampton, who will be followed by Catherine Myers. Please state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. And Ms. Myers, if you want to come down and sit in the other seat so that you can go next, but go ahead.
They think they were only allowed to have one by some email communication. Can they both speak?
Oh, they can both speak.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. I'm Catherine Myers, so I will begin as long as I'm here. Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Myers, and I, along with Marie Hampton, am the co-founder and co-executive director of a Minnesota-based organization, Live More, Screen Less. Our organization mission is to enhance the digital well-being of young people. We accomplish our mission by working for and with young people and educators. Our first step in our process is listening. We listen to students through listening sessions and classroom discussions. We often ask students to describe their digital media experiences. As you ponder your role in stopping social media companies from targeting children's attention with ads, images, and content that has the potential to diminish their well-being, I want you to hear the lived experiences from Minnesota students. These teenagers describe the struggle they face in stopping social media companies from interfering with their lives. Please remember, these are 15 to 18-year-olds. Here are their words. In middle school, I was on social media 24/7. I had an addiction to posting. It was terrible. I would just post every minute, just to see how many views I was getting. I know TikTok's definitely a big issue with a lot of people at school where it's really bad because, well, it's that endless. You can just keep doing it. You literally can just keep doing it, and it's impossible to stop. I have seen things I should not have seen. Parents have forgotten how harmful the internet can be, especially to younger kids. There's just like a lot less restriction on social media platforms, and anyone has access to really anything at any time of day. Yeah, that takes a toll. You see young children, iPad kids who are severely addicted to their iPads at such a young age, it's highly addictive. It cannot be good for someone's brain at that age, looking at a screen for so long. I have an issue with online gaming where I will actually just straight up lose track of time. And I think I'm on there for an hour, and it'll be like 5 hours later on the weekends. And I'm not even kidding. I've not eaten for 5 hours, but I won't have realized it. It's really a problem.
And I have to ask you to wrap up your testimony.
Thank you. The ever-present and manipulative design of technology's algorithm places too much of a burden on young people. These are people with developing brains. Please listen to the voices of young people and hold big tech accountable. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Catherine Myers, who will be followed by Maggie Hange.
Good
Hello, thank you. Chair Stevenson, my name is Marie Hampton, and I'm the co-founder, together with KK, of Live More, Screen Less. I just wanted to share a few comments with you after hearing the voices of young people that KK just shared. So the ever-present nature and manipulative design of technology's algorithms places too much of a burden on our parents, on our teachers, and especially on our young people. I don't think you could find a Minnesota high school, middle, or even elementary student in Minnesota who is not struggling against the pull of technology to capture their attention. Parents are not winning in their attempt to keep harmful content out of reach of their children. Teachers are up against a battle with the pull of technology in the classroom, and young people very well aware, as you just heard, of how easy it is to get pulled into technology much longer than they intend. Last month, Josh Golan, Executive Director of Fairplay, testified at a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I just want to share a few of Josh's comments. For more than a decade, social media companies have been performing a vast, uncontrolled experiment on our children. They use reams of data that they collect on young people and endless A/B testing to fine-tune their platform's algorithms and designed to maximize engagement. Because more time and activity on the platform means more revenue for them. And because the way these platforms engage with young people is largely unregulated, there is no obligation to consider and mitigate these harmful effects. The resulting impact on children and families have been devastating. Compulsive overuse, exposure to harmful and age-inappropriate content, cyberbullying, eating disorders, harms to mental health, and sexual exploitation of children are just some of the problems linked to big tech's insidious business model. So as lawmakers, please consider that you have this opportunity to address the root cause of the problems noted by Josh Golan. You can hold big tech accountable and be a leader in a nation for digital well-being. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Maggie Hangi, who will be followed by Lisa Radzak.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Hangi. I'm the policy associate at the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Bishops of Minnesota. I'm here today to share our support for HF 1503. It is vital for teen development that we prohibit the use of algorithms that feed inappropriate or unfiltered content and cultivate addictive behavior. Limiting the impact of social media provides a concrete step towards mitigating these evidential harms during teens' most formative years. 95% of teens ages 13 to 17 have access to a smartphone, 45% say they are online almost constantly, and another 44% say that they are on the internet several times a day, according to a 2018 Pew Research study. A 2023 report by the CDC exposed that nearly 3 in 5 teenage girls felt persistent sadness in 2021, and 1 in 3 girls seriously considered attempting suicide, up 60% from a decade ago. In addition, youth who spend the most time on social media reportedly have 13 to 66% higher depression rate. It is not a secret that the increased use of social media has contributed to these feelings of sadness, anxiety, and depression. The goal of these algorithms is to keep users engaged in the platform for as long as possible, which in turn gives a false fabrication of connectedness and reality. The way algorithms are set up, we get fed what we see or click on. So with TikTok, if you linger on a video for even a short period of time, the algorithm will take note and feed you additional similar content. This can be especially dangerous to youth if the content promotes suicide or self-harm, which it has been known to do. A December 2022 study showed that when teens create a TikTok account, it can take less than 3 minutes for them to see content related to suicide and about 5 more minutes for them to find a community promoting eating disorders. We should not be letting big tech and their accompanying algorithms shepherd the lives of our children. With the passage of HF 1503, we can limit the control these algorithms have over our teens and free them from the confines of social media giants who do not have their best interests in mind. Thank you.
Next is Lisa Radzak, followed by Tyler Deers.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Radzak. I'm the executive director of WithAll. We are a Minnesota-based not-for-profit serving a national audience with eating disorder recovery support and with resources for adults to empower all of us to prevent eating disorders from developing in kids in the first place. I want to outline one example of why with all very much supports House File 1503. In April 2022, the organization Fair Play, a national nonprofit that looks at how marketing impacts kids, released a report, Designing for Disorder, Instagram's pro-eating disorder bubble. This report documents how Meta's Instagram platform promotes an extensive pro-eating disorder bubble and how they turn a small but steady profit from this bubble. It finds the pro-eating disorder bubble on Instagram includes 90,000 unique accounts and reaches 20 million unique followers on the platform. This is about 1 in 75 Instagram users who follow someone in this bubble. The research found children as young as 9 and 10 following 3 or more pro-eating disorder accounts with a median age of 19. One-third of Instagram's pro-eating disorder bubble is underage, and they have over 500,000 followers. Meta derives an estimated $2 million in revenue a year from this bubble and $227.9 million from all those who follow this bubble. Algorithms are profiling children and teens to serve images, memes, and videos encouraging restrictive diets and extreme weight loss. And in turn, Instagram is promoting and recommending children and teens eating disorder content to 500,000 people globally. On behalf of the one-third of young people throughout Minnesota right now who are dealing with disordered eating and the approximately 9% of Minnesotans suffering with an eating disorder, let me add this. As I do this work every day, knowing that a third of our young people are spending this precious time and brain space with eating disorders or disordered eating, I can tell you that what we are talking about today, this is the tip of the iceberg. Our youngest kids are exposed to media messages at rates that most of us in this room can't comprehend. We had to wait about a month for the magazine to come in the mail that maybe had some of the harmful messages in it. Our kids today are being saturated with this, like as though they're being under a fire hose. I will end by saying I hope that you'll support this legislation, and thank you for your time and service to Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Tyler Dears, who will be followed by Jordan Rodell.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. Tyler Dears with TechNet, Technology Trade Association. We are in opposition to House File 1503, and Chair, with your indulgence, I do have letters as well for committee's distribution.
Ask our page to distribute those.
The page, please. Thank you. We do appreciate some of the clarity that was put forth in the amendment that was adopted today. I know there were some services that were exempted that probably were never the intent of the bill, so we appreciate that. I know there were some technical changes that were addressed with the amendment as well, but we still remain opposed. Look, the fact is the internet runs, as we know it, on algorithms. Any sequence of code is an algorithm, and almost all connect on a website that is somewhat user-generated. We, as in our companies that would be affected by this, we simply are not sure how this would even work. And like the previous bill is before us, this is kind of new territory, somewhat avant-garde. Companies under this would have to verify the age of all Minnesotans to weed out and verify who would be affected by this proposal, even if they currently do not do so. Then the company would have to make sure that those who are under the age of 18 have age verifiable consent from a parent. I will also notice that the amendment deletes the provision in there that would require or allow a legal guardian from the bill. It's just parents, so I'm not sure if, or it's unclear under the amendment, if you don't have a parent, how you would be allowed on social media. The new age verification requirements in the bill are also problematic. This would result in capturing massive amounts of sensitive, personally identifiable information. A few ways companies could do this is to comply with the requirements would be take a photo, the parents would take a photo of their driver's license, which again is new information the companies are not collecting, or the companies could deploy facial recognition technology, which uses artificial intelligence to verify the age of the account holder's legal parent. Again, not 100% all the time. And, you know, don't take it from us, but the French regulator as well has said that age verification has been proven to be unreliable and violates privacy rights of all citizens. So the parental consent part is definitely problematic for from our angle. This is all to say that there are many First Amendment issues as well, too. We've seen this play out before in several other jurisdictions and have seen them go down on First Amendment basis as well. We think this would likely welcome a court challenge. But in closing, I just want to say that companies, the two major mobile operating systems do have parental controls in there. So if you're a parent, you want to have your kid's phone, you can already right now say, hey, no, it's social media apps for you. The parents have that power to do that. I know that's somewhat duplicative of what's already in the proposed amendment. So, again, we appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
If only it was that easy, Mr. Rodell, or Mr. Deers. Sorry, Ms. Rodell.
Hello, everyone. Again, thank you, Chair Stevenson, and the committee for hearing my testimony today. Again, my name is Ron Rodell, State Policy Manager at the Computer and Communications Industry Association. I'll skip the larger introduction and just say that CCIA unequivocally supports the implementation of mechanisms that ensure children's safety online. However, there are several concerns we would like to raise with the policies House File 1503 would implement. First, the bill may put Minnesotans at greater risk of harm, including children whom the bill seeks to protect. CCIA is concerned that businesses may be forced to collect parental verification data, which would paradoxically force companies to collect a higher volume of data on users. Businesses may be forced to accumulate personal information they do not want to collect and consumers do not want to give. That data collection creates extra privacy and security risks for everyone. It is also important to highlight that highly sensitive personal information about children would also have to be collected and stored, including collecting and storing their geolocation data to ensure they do not reside outside of the state when confirming that they are the age of the users that are using these services. Second, the bill lacks narrowly tailored definitions. In its original form, House File 1503 indirectly defines a child as anyone under 18. Due to the nuanced ways in which children under the age of 18 use the internet, it is imperative to tailor such treatments to respective age groups appropriately. We suggest tailoring the definition of child to a user under the age of 13 to align with the Federal Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, standard. Lastly, the private right of action would result in the proliferation of frivolous lawsuits. By creating a new private right of action, the measure would open the doors of Minnesota's courthouses to plaintiffs advancing frivolous claims with little evidence of actual injury. We appreciate your consideration of these comments and stand ready to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Jeff Tollefson, who will be followed by Andrew O'Connor. I'm sorry, Mr. Tollefson, I didn't give you the on-deck warning.
No, that's okay.
I was too busy making a snippy comment.
Thank
you. Tollefson.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Tollefson. I serve as president of the Minnesota Technology Association, representing the interests of tech-enabled companies in Minnesota. And I'm here today to voice our concerns in opposition to House File 1503 in its current form. First, I want to acknowledge Representative Robbins and all of those for the intent of this bill. Rest assured that our MinTech member companies take seriously the responsibility of providing safe online environments for all Minnesotans. But this surprisingly brief legislation for a very complex issue creates a multitude of unintended consequences, ranging from implicating non-social media companies, like some of Minnesota's major retailers that leverage user-generated content to optimize a shopping experience, to negatively impacting the ability of older teens, such as those over the age of 13, from leveraging and using online platforms to perform research for school projects, to search for jobs, or make purchases online. It would also inadvertently put Minnesotans at greater risk of harm, including children that the bill seeks to protect as a result of the confidential information that would need to be shared in order to show proof of age, and the geolocation information that would need to be collected and stored to ensure they do not reside outside of Minnesota when confirming they are of age to use these services. I won't go into detail in terms of all the specific areas of concern, as I believe the letters that have been submitted highlight many of those concerns and trust you understand some of the issues being raised. We're not in any way against protecting children from targeted content related to issues such as eating disorders, self-harm, smoking, drinking, et cetera. But we do not believe that this overly broad and vague bill, coupled with the private right of action, is the answer. We support the bill's intent to keep children safe online, but House File 1503 in its current form creates more questions than answers and negatively impacts Minnesota residents and businesses in ways we trust you do not intend. We appreciate the committee's consideration of the oral and written concerns shared, and we stand ready to provide additional information and context as requested. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Andrew O'Connor, followed by Corey Marshall.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew O'Connor. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Entertainment Software Association. We represent video game console makers and game publishers. We are respectfully opposing House File 1503 and have submitted written testimony which outlines our concerns in more details. I'll start by saying that we appreciate the intent of the bill and acknowledge that keeping children safe online is a priority. The video game industry has long supported these efforts to keep children safe and has been a leader in this space for decades. The video game industry was praised for its benefits during the pandemic to both mental health and to also community building during a very lonely time for many people. However, this bill is too broad and may have unintended consequences, especially for video game platforms. And for my testimony, I will focus on two key points. The first being algorithms and games don't create an echo chamber for others' thoughts and ideas. They help players find games that they are most likely to enjoy and to help build communities. For example, algorithms may take user-created game clips to narrow the field and recommend games like one a user has played before. Second, various state and federal laws that provide data protection specific to teenagers do not require parental consent and instead give the teenager the ability to make decisions about how their data is used. Specifically, no state law requires a teenager to obtain parental consent for the collection or use of their data. There are unclear identification verification standards in this bill, which will require additional data collection on every person registering a new account in the state of Minnesota. In conclusion, this is a vague bill with outlier requirements. With private right of action and no regulatory oversight, this bill would subject the entire online ecosystem to unnecessary litigation risk. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. And last, we have Corey Marshall.
Good afternoon again. Hello. Good afternoon again, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Corey Marshall, and I serve as the Director of State and Local Government, Government Relations, Central Region for the Chamber of Progress, a tech industry coalition committed to ensuring all Americans benefit from technological leaps. Our corporate partners include companies like Amazon, Apple, and Google, but our partners do not have a vote or voice in our decisions or in our positions. We urge our committee to oppose HF 1503. It was noted earlier that this type of legislation encourages business innovation. It does not. This bill's constructive knowledge standard for platforms regarding the age of potential minors on their system compels proactive age verification. This outcome results from the bill stating that a platform is liable, and I quote, if the operator of a social media platform knew or had reason to know that the individual account holder was under the age of 18, end quote. There is disagreement about the best methods for verifying users' ages, but they could include techniques like facial recognition or other biometric scans. Even less invasive methods like requiring users to enter their birth date or ID or driver's license in order to enter a site would still require widespread data collection. These techniques would have to be used for every user, not just children, resulting in increased data collection for everyone on the internet, as mentioned earlier, even everyone around this panel. HF 1503 requires social media platforms to obtain permission from legal guardians before allowing users under the age of 18 to create an account. This requirement could limit access to supportive communities and resources for groups who need it the most. For marginalized teens or those looking for support, social media can be especially beneficial. LGBTQ plus youth often turn to social media for resources and connection to supportive communities they might not otherwise have at home. Teens looking for information on reproductive or sexual health services, including abortion, access, or rape crisis centers, can use social media to be connected with expert and community resources. Look, at a time when books with LGBTQ plus themes are being banned from our school libraries and reproductive rights are under attack all across this country, this bill could cut off teens from the potentially life-saving resources social media can and does provide. In conclusion, HF 1503 would eliminate some of the tools platforms use to keep children safe online and would cut off marginalized groups from social connections and other helpful resources. We respectfully urge this committee to oppose HF 1503. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the public testimony. We'll move to member discussion and comments, and I'll maybe start with a brief one of my own, which is to say that I'm impressed that we heard this bill last year and we had a very different argument from the social media companies. Last year, the argument was more, no, you must understand the algorithms are the things that are doing good in the world. And I remember someone made a comment of this is like saying you can't ban cigarettes because then people won't have the benefit of the filter, which I thought was ridiculous. But now this year, it's, boy, can't pass this bill. It's going to result in too much data collection on individuals, which to me is also absurd. Never in the history of humanity has more people has a company known more about an individual than any specific social media company. If I think about buying a new pair of shoes, I'm going to see ads for the next week on my social media ad. It's just the pot calling the kettle black. So that's my editorial, Representative Petizza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Robbins, thank you for bringing this bill forward again. I was a co-author last year. I haven't yet signed on this year. I have a couple of questions. I know we're running a little bit short on time, but I appreciate the leeway here, Mr. Chair. I think, I mean, as I look around the room today, and if I didn't age myself enough in our Taylor Swift conversation last week, I think I'm the youngest member on this committee. What that means is that I was the first generation of people to be on Facebook. My college professor, my senior year, recommended that we check out some new app called Twitter. And so kind of growing up in that era, another reference to Taylor Swift, it's been really interesting. And it's been eye-opening now as a mother of four children. My oldest is nine. We have absolutely just shut down any conversation about cell phones. My kids don't have their own iPads, aside from their school affiliated ones. And but I think that it's really, really important that we ground ourselves in all the negative things that are happening on social media today. I mean, we know that terrorists, we know that incels, something even worse than fake news, which is knowably and provably false news, spreads like wildfire on these platforms. But I'm curious why this bill only limits to larger platforms. Representative Robbins, I'm curious. It's like a million users globally?
Yes, a million users.
Representative Robbins.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes, a million users globally. We just felt like that was reasonable. That's where most teens are. That's where most of the problem is. And getting below that, one of the arguments that was earlier raised in other hearings last year was that, well, we'll stifle the internet, we'll stifle innovation. So we're allowing the smaller platforms to figure it out, but hopefully this would capture most of the harm that's out there.
One additional quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, when we explore some of the similarities between your bill and Representative Bonner's bill from before, I mean, some of the de facto age requirements that one of the testifiers was just sharing, I think of the verification that we're required to provide as politicians on Facebook these days. You know, we have to just send both pictures, both front and back pictures of our driver's license. And so I think, you know, that there are good reasons to collect certain kinds of data, and to what the chair said earlier, I mean, this data is already being collected a lot of the time. So I think, I mean, I'll just leave it with that. I think that, you know, there are some similarities between these two bills that we've heard today, and I think it's really important that we continue the conversation and just make sure that people, particularly our children, are being protected from some of the negative information that can just really swirl around and around and make it seem like everybody's doing this, and if you're not doing this, then, you know, you're worth less, or you are. I'll leave it at that. I appreciate you bringing it forward. I think we do have a lot more to talk about as this moves on, but that's.
And we're going to have to move pretty quickly here. We've got now four members on the list and probably about 7 minutes. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner. Clearly, I am a co-author on the bill.
Sorry, I'm Representative Robbins.
Robbins, sorry. What did I call you? Representative Robbins, I'm sorry. Clearly, I'm a co-author on the bill, and I will just say, you know, I am one of those very engaged, responsible parents. My kids don't get cell phones until they're drivers. And I lock them down. But you know what? I shared a story earlier today where one of my kids, I had all the apps closed off. They couldn't have access to them. And one of my kids got access to the internet through a news app. I had no idea that they could do that, but you better believe kids know how to get around everything. I have another kid who access some pornography, and it's not because he was looking for it. But I could go back through the search history and see exactly how he got there based on the search terms he was using that had nothing to do with pornography. So I'm a co-author on this bill because I believe it's really important. And I will say again that my goal in this legislature is to protect children. And that should be our focus, is protecting children. Now, that said, I do have some real questions that I had not thought about when we first started this conversation. One, I will ask two questions and I'll be done.
As long as they're very
One would be, and I don't know, Representative Robbins, if you are the person to answer this question or if it would be somebody from the industry, from TechNet or something. But one question would be, this is very focused on the algorithm. And so my question would be then, how, in absence of the algorithm, and I do understand that the algorithm can be used positively as well and to redirect people in a positive direction. So in absence of the algorithm, what will be used to feed content into a system? Are we at risk of paid content rising to the top, or like what are sort of the other risks associated with that as far as what's pushing content into a feed? And my other question that I had not considered that we discussed on the last bill is this issue of geocoding. Because this is focused to Minnesota, that's something I hadn't thought about. But how will we address that issue of geocoding? And we're going to have to know where people are in order for this bill and this language to apply. So how are we going to tackle that issue of geocoding?
And Representative Robbins, I know those are big questions. I'm sure you can follow up afterwards with Representative Brindley, but
I'd be happy to have a more detailed discussion on the first part about how the algorithm will work. If you look at the bill in lines 1-8 through 116, we've created this definition of recommendation feature that, just for the benefit of the committee, I worked over the interim on this bill with people who used to work at Google in their integrity unit, and they helped me with this legislation and these definitions. So I feel like it's really expertly defined for the purpose of stopping people from getting the unsolicited content. So your child can like or follow whatever they want. It is content neutral, contrary to what the opponent said. One of the reasons these bills keep getting struck down all over the country is because they're struck down on First Amendment grounds about protecting kids from harmful content. We are not doing that. This is content neutral. A child can follow or like anything, and that will show up in their feed in chronological order. So what's not happening is, based on their likes, based on how long they linger on something, based on things they've searched on, they're not getting shoved additional things that they haven't liked or followed at them. So their feed will be what they have liked and followed, and we are not policing what that content is.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion about that definition. I was looking at that as well. I certainly share the goal of making sure kids aren't exposed to harmful content. It does seem like a pretty broad definition. I mean, a recommendation feature is any metric of user engagement, including but not limited to the length of time something is viewed. So I guess I'm just wondering if a young person uses a social media platform to look up information about how to quit vaping or mental health assistance or how to get involved in a political campaign, and they click on the first link they see and they look at it for a little bit of time, would the social media platform then be prohibited from showing them related content, even though those are, I would think, pretty good goals of the young person?
Representative Robbins.
Yes, so the recommendation feature is the definition. Then if you look at the actual prohibition, it says that they're prohibited from using the algorithm to target user-generated content, but it doesn't prohibit them from following the things they like or search for. So an immediate, I think it's number 3 there, providing search results to an account holder who is under 18 if it is response to a specific and immediately preceding query. So they can search for political campaigns, they can search for anything, but based on that search, it won't send them additional stuff they haven't searched for.
Okay, and we are out of time, so I will renew my motion that House File 22, that House File 1503 be, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails, and House File 1503 as amended is recommended to be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. The meeting is adjourned.